Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, July 29th. We'll talk about the situation in Portland now, increasingly capturing the attention of the rest of the country, which might typically consider what happens in Oregon kind of its own private Idaho, to mix Northwest metaphors, with maybe not much relevance for Chicago or Miami or New York or maybe even San Francisco or LA. But does the special intensity of the Portland protest movement, the mix of protesters and what they want, and President Trump deploying federal police mean that what happens in Portland doesn't just stay in Portland? We have three guests: Anna Griffin, Vice President of News at Oregon Public Broadcasting; Dr. Shirley A. Jackson, Professor of Black Studies at Portland State University; and Ann Applebaum, staff writer at The Atlantic, historian and author of the book Twilight of Democracy: The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. Thank you all so much for joining us. And Anna Griffin, what's the latest, as in how did last night go?
Good morning, Brian. Thanks for having me. It was another typical night in Portland. We had a relatively peaceful protest of 1,000 people or so that culminated with the crowd gathering around our downtown federal courthouse. There was a fence surrounding it. People shook the fence. They set small fires at the fence. They threw things over the fence. They shot off fireworks at the building. It is stone, so it's not likely that's going to burn it down. And then federal officers responded with force. They came out and used tear gas, pepper balls, rubber bullets, and they ended up in the streets away from the courthouse trying to disperse the crowd with some fairly intense weapons.
Someone I know in Portland, Anna, wrote me this question to ask regarding media coverage, so I will, and it might be instructive for people anywhere in the country to hear your answer. The person writes, "Is it possible to return the coverage focus of the protests to Black Lives Matter and policing instead of the feds, or to separate those narratives?" That's the question. So can you do that? How much are there two different sets of protests taking place in Portland, or how should the rest of America understand that mix?
You know, I think the protests are still about Black Lives Matter. If you go down there, those are the speeches that you hear. Those are the chants that you hear. They have taken on an element of not just fighting systemic racism, but fighting creeping authoritarianism. And I think, you know, there's been some concern expressed from some within the Black Lives Matter movement that what is happening right now is a distraction. I don't think it's too cynical to say that maybe that's the entire point of what the federal government is doing. But for folks on the ground, these two issues are fundamentally intertwined: systemic racism, which we suffer in Oregon, which we suffer as a nation, and the role the federal government plays in inequity everywhere.
And Dr. Shirley Jackson, sociologist teaching in the Black Studies Department at Portland State, let me get your take on that, because I saw you quoted saying many, many Black people in Portland are using the word hijacked to describe what's happening to the movement that originally existed. So can you respond to what Anna described and elaborate on your concern?
Sure. And I do like what Anna said. I think that there is definitely some validity to that. But I also think that when you start directing efforts to something that is much larger in terms of, say, the federal government, for African Americans who have been directly impacted by policing tactics, police brutality, police killings, that is the focus that many of them are looking at. That is something that was central to the Black Lives Matter movements that were happening not just in the U.S., not just in Oregon, but globally. And I think that for those who are thinking about that as a central focus, this does seem to be a distraction. Now, I will say that I do agree that it may be linked, but for some, that link may not be as clear as it is for others. And the attack on the federal courthouse is something that I think for many African Americans and others, I would say others as well, because I've been contacted by a lot of people who are responding to some of the things I've said, And they said, yes, we want to support Black Lives Matter, but we can't quite get behind what is happening downtown in Portland right now at the federal courthouse.
And my Portland source writes about hijacking that word, the protests, writes, pushing that story is a strategy by the Trump administration to divide the protesters against each other and distract the rest of us. The administration wants a perception of Black Lives Matter versus Antifa, plays right into their hands. So how much are you concerned about that being the outcome of a critique like the one you were just describing?
I think that word hijacking can be used in multiple ways with respect to this particular situation. It is hijacking when you have protesters who are coming in with their own agendas and are basically taking over a movement that was, by and large, something that was widely accepted by a large number of people. You can also look at it as hijacked with respect to the federal government's intervention. You now start to focus on a particular location in the country. You start to use heavy-handed tactics to quell a situation. And really, I think what's happening is it's a message that's being sent to other cities around the country. Don't mess with me. You know, that sort mm-hmm. of situation. And we do know that that tends to be the way that the present administration thinks. This is a personal thing. This is not something that involves other people per se. So it becomes a personal attack where, you know, protesters are seen as being disruptive and anti-administration. And I have to say, rightly so in this case.
Anne Applebaum, author of Twilight of Democracy, The Seductive Lure of Authoritarianism. I'll tell our listeners that your background is in the center-right politically in Poland, now very dismayed by global conservatives turning from the ways that conservatism emphasizes freedom toward the ways it emphasizes authoritarianism. If that's a fair description of your starting point, how does Portland, USA look through your Europe-based lens?
So thank you. First of all, I should say that unlike the other guests, I am not in Portland. And so, I can only comment on what I see as part of other patterns. And I don't have an inside, view of what's happening there. What immediately struck me, though, about the Trump administration's decision to send federal troops there was that it was really contrary to everything that we know about policing difficult situations, political protests from other countries. I also used to write a little bit about Northern Ireland. And it is, there are manuals written about this, that when you have a delicate protest like that, you do not send heavily armed, men wearing camouflage military style uniforms and try to put the protest down with something that looks like brute force, because that creates a counter-reaction and is much more likely to increase the violence. And so when I saw that happening there, my first reaction was they must know what they're doing and they must be doing it on purpose. And what it looks to me, and not only me, that what the administration's tactic is to increase the violence in order to produce pictures, photographs, material that can be used on Fox News, where it's already been used, and then eventually in the Trump administration's own messaging and campaign advertisements, designed what they're showing their supporters is, look, we are using force to put down this chaos, to put down this violence. And I'm sure, they don't distinguish between Black Lives Matters and Antifa and other groups. You know, the idea is that, there's chaos in our cities. It's an urban disaster. This is Democrats are responsible for this. And we're showing you pictures of how we will crush this movement, this chaos. And that seems to me the purpose of this event. And it's a tactic that has been used in other places. by other authoritarian leaders. And of course, that doesn't mean that they aren't also doing things that are in violation of people's rights or that are in violation of traditions about what state and federal law enforcement do. But the use of this instead of incidents from the administration's point of view, it seems to me, is the pictures and the photographs that can then be, then will be used to appeal to people who are afraid. People are made nervous by what they see as disruption and chaos. And it's sending a message, we can put this down. And, mm-hmm. that's my analysis.
So in that context, here's U.S. Attorney General William Barr in congressional testimony yesterday characterizing the federal deployment in Portland and what they're responding to, according to him.
What unfolds nightly around the courthouse cannot reasonably be called protest. It is, by any objective measure, an assault on the government of the United States.
So, Anne, what you're seeing, and I realize it's from media reports, not from being on the ground in Portland, but from the coverage you're seeing and what you know of the Trump administration generally, how much does that ring true to you? From what's actually going on, as far as you could tell.
So I can certainly say that that is the narrative that they want to project. So they are characterizing this in their messaging and their advertising as we are protecting the United States against people who want to destroy the United States. And they see very much the federal courthouse as a symbol. What I'm hoping will happen in the next few days and weeks, and my colleagues who are in Portland will have to tell me whether this is realistic, is that protesters will also understand that they've been caught up in this narrative, and they will change their tactics because the appearance of violence, the appearance of conflict, the escalation of the conflict, the impression that it's the troops of the United States fighting some kind of alien force, this is the message that they are trying to get across to people.
Anne Griffin from Oregon Public Broadcasting, I see the story on your site from Monday, headline, Portland Leaders Seek Ceasefire in a Meeting with Federal Officials. Is there some kind of real peace process, if that's the right term, going on here?
There are negotiations going on right now, and we're actually expecting an announcement today. The governor's office confirmed late last night that they are negotiating with the federal government, and don't stop and think too much about the idea of city and state governments negotiating a ceasefire with Washington, D.C., because it will wreck your brain. But the conversation right now involves replacing federal officers at the courthouse downtown with state officers. The governor controls both the Oregon National Guard and the state police, and that would give local leaders more control over the amount of force that would be used, and it would also let the protest become solely about Black Lives Matter and racial equity again, as opposed to, as Dr. Jackson pointed out, this has become a conversation about a lot more than that. And I think what everybody here wants is a return to the conversation that actually needs to happen right now about how do we fix a system that we know is fundamentally unjust.
So, Dr. Jackson, after 60-plus days in a row in the streets, should or how should this phase of the racial justice movement end, in your opinion, and move on to what Anne was just describing? And how would you define success?
One of the things that I could not wrap my brain around for the longest was why it took so long for local leaders to actually come together and talk about what needs to be done. And I was really concerned that, and I'm so happy to hear what Anne said, because I think she really hit the nail on the head. The response to what has happened in Portland and what is happening in Portland does seem to be quite orchestrated. And I think that one of the things that people would like to really see is that return to discussions that were taking place initially, and somehow they just simply got placed on the back burner because the focus then became the federal courthouse. There have not been any real clear demands. So let's just say people get into the federal courthouse, they wreck the building, what have you, then what? So there needs to be a clear plan what next? And community leaders, local politicians need to have that conversation, and they really don't seem to have done it successfully. And I think that that is what has also really contributed to this problem. Mm-hmm. So I'm happy to see that they're having these conversations, although I don't really agree with that term ceasefire. I actually think moratorium is probably a little bit more accurate, just because ceasefire connotes the, you know, idea of violence yeah. on both parts. But anyway, so
well,
I think things are changing.
If I could, Brian, follow up for just one second, it's important to note, you know, Dr. Jackson talks about distraction. The protests prior to the federal government coming in had been wildly successful. The state
yes.
legislature has set aside $62 million to put into Black-led organizations and programs that benefit Black Oregonians. The Portland City Council had ended the use of armed police officers in the public schools. They had ended the very controversial police team focused on gun violence. So if anybody came in and hijacked what was happening in Portland, it was very much the federal government. Mm.
Ann Applebaum, here's a clip from Portland that's relevant to the conversation that the other guests were just having, played on NPR's Morning Edition today, attributed by them to civil rights leader Katrina Holland, asking people to look differently at property damage by protesters than they often do.
It is the language of the unheard. Perhaps we should stop casting stones on the fact that people choose to set fire to a building or take a rock through a window and acknowledge the pain that's behind that and acknowledge the root of what is causing that.
So if that's representative of anybody but herself, then not everybody's ready for a ceasefire or a truce or a moratorium or call it whatever.
That is, you know, it may be representative of her feelings of pain, the use of these property destruction. It may express what a lot of protesters feel. But I worry that as a political tactic, as a communications tactic, as a way of talking to other Americans and talking to other Oregonians, it will not succeed. It will not have the reaction that she wants it to have. It will instead make people turn against the movement. It will instead make them afraid. People are bothered by images of property destruction and violence, and there could be a backlash. That's not to take away the legitimacy of her point of view, but I am not sure that is a successful way to win. I mean, look, there's a long history of this argument between the utility of peaceful protest versus violent protest. It's been taking place in our country in the 1960s. And, you know, it's my view that overwhelmingly peaceful protests are the ones that succeed in the long term because they can convince more people. They can bring along with them, you know, people who were not, you know, initially involved. They can convince more people. It's a more effective method of winning an argument.
And yeah, Anna Griffin exactly. from Oregon Public Radio, how does that clip inform or refute what you were saying a minute ago about ceasefire not being the right term because the violence is all coming from one side? I know there are different interpretations of whether property damage should be tagged with the word violence, but nevertheless, it's property damage.
It is property damage, and I think what you hear from activists is they don't like it, but at the same time, this is, you know, this is a movement. I think some people would call this a reckoning. Some people would call it a revolution, and dishes will be broken, so to speak. It's also some context. Portland has a long history of protests that culminate with small splinter groups doing damage. I think the role of Antifa as sort of an organized force in all this has been overblown, but we have seen here, particularly since 2016, a series of freedom of speech protests by right-wing groups that invariably culminate with fights between, I think, what you would call Black Bloc or Antifa and right-wing quasi-militia groups. So folks here, to a certain extent, you know, we're not inured to it, but we are used to it happening. I would also argue that a lot of how the message of what these protests started has been distorted in some ways by, I hate to criticize the national media, but the national media has seized on exactly the images that the Trump administration wants folks to seize on, the violence. And the national media has amplified again and again through this the white voices of people who are out protesting the federal government. Your listeners have probably seen the image of the white woman who sat down naked in the street. They've probably seen the viral video of the Navy veteran getting batoned after he went down to ask federal officers how they could violate their oath this way. The vast majority of thousands of people who are out there every night are not out there protesting against the federal government. They're still out there because this is about Black Lives Matter.
Ann Applebaum, author of Twilight of Democracy, I know you have to go in a minute, so give us a closing thought from your perspective in terms of what you see as at stake for the rest of America and even the world from Portland.
So I think that what's at stake is the ideals of some of the Black Lives Matter protesters. Will they get their ideas across to the rest of American society? Will they be able to be heard and understood, or will they fall into this trap, whereby they are characterized by the Trump administration as an us versus them, the U.S. government versus violent protest, the U.S. government putting down anti-American forces, and it's really important that movement leaders, Black and white, actually, and protesters in Portland, find a way out of this and make sure that they are not caught up in this real dangerous and stupid game.
Ann Applebaum, thank you very much for joining us. Not mincing words and getting a laugh, not always an easy combination. Thank you so much. And so for our other two guests, in our last 2 minutes, a minute for each of you, if we can keep these short, to explain to the rest of the country why Portland. Anna Griffin from Oregon Public Broadcasting, an overwhelmingly white city, a kind of, you know, peaceful hippie backwater as far as a lot of the rest of the country thinks of Portland, accurately or not. Why is Portland the most, I shouldn't say sleepy, more like creative hippie backwater, but why is Portland the most intense protest city in America? And what are the implications for the rest of the country?
I would say hipster, not hippie at this point, Brian.
There you
but,
go.
You know, I, the politics here are fascinated and complicated. Oregon has a long, dark history of systemic institutional racism. It is a state founded on some basic ideals of white supremacy that for a long time had laws barring people of color from even owning property. So racial tensions here go back a very long way. Oregon has a long history of protest and liberal politics and fights with the federal government. George H.W. Bush called Portland Little Beirut when they protested the first Iraq war. Oregon is also in many ways still the frontier. This is a place that is very liberal, but is also libertarian in some ways. We don't necessarily think we're better than you are, but we would like you to leave us alone. And it's a small city, a really easy place for the federal government to come in, establish a beachhead in our very small downtown, and they know from history that this is a community that has a certain activist bent that will rise up and really loudly protest what is ostensibly kind of a federal occupation.
Hippie, hipster, maybe we should just say Portlandia and leave it at that. But Dr. Jackson, anything to add on why Portland is the most intense protest city in America right now, 2 months after George Floyd was killed in Minneapolis, Minnesota?
I think that one of the things that we have to also recognize is the demographics of Portland. So 6% of Portland is African American. And by and large, when
small.
You have protests in a place where the large majority of the population is white and very small percentages of the population are black, in something like Black Lives Matter, as much as you might want to see a large number of blacks participating, they are still going to be overwhelmingly white protesters. And unfortunately, what tends to sometimes happen is well-intentioned whites might not be aware of their own privilege, even in a Black Lives Matter protest, even in some other type of protest that might be for a variety of groups, that they end up oftentimes making the narrative. And that narrative, unfortunately, is sometimes based on their experiences and not the experiences of the very people that they presume to be speaking for. And that's the problem. They sometimes are speaking for rather than with.
And that's the last word from Dr. Shirley A. Jackson, professor of sociology teaching in the Black Studies Department at Portland State University, and Anna Griffin, vice president of news at Oregon Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much, really, for sharing so much time with us. And I know it's early in the morning out there, so double thanks for that. Thank you, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a Daily Politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.